Hello, and welcome to the Angelist India Radio. Through these conversations, we're taking you inside the minds of great investors, experienced founders, and talented experts. Angelist India pioneered new concepts in startup fundraising and investing for India. You can find out more about us on angel.co/India. Let's dive in. Hey, listeners. Over the last few conversations, we've had amazing set of VCs and amazing set of founders to unpack what's going on in this world. And today's guest is somebody who I've had a close working relationship with him and his firm as well. So on the show, I'm excited to welcome Tarun of Matrix Partners. Matrix is a venture firm in India. They manage close to $1 billion, maybe over $1 billion. And they backed some prominent household names like Ola Cabs, Razorpay, and many more. So welcome, Tarun, to the show. Today, I have an interesting set of questions lined up, but we'll keep this freestyle like we always do on our freewheeling chats. So welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Utsav. Really a pleasure to be here and great to be doing this together with you.
Amazing. So I think a topic that's top of the mind for a lot of people right now, we've gone through a pretty horrible COVID phase in India right now. The second wave was devastating. But the technology world is not stopping. The startup world and the founders are resilient. What are your takes when I mention that those two words together, COVID and Indian startups?
Yeah, so, you know, it's been a little bit of a roller coaster year for everybody in the ecosystem. I would say starting with obviously the personal tragedy that, you know, so many of us, our colleagues, our founders, their teams have had to go through. So it has been, you know, truly tragic in that sense. On the flip side, though, I think, you know, the work has been, I would say, unlike anything anyone had expected. I remember last March when things had just started to kind of pick up as far as COVID in India. A lot of people kind of, you know, feared the worst, right? Which is, okay, this is the end. A lot of companies will die. A lot of large companies, you know, won't be able to make it because business will be down to zero for several months, several quarters. And obviously, now that happened, right? And it just kind of goes back to show just how bad everyone is at forecasting. And so I think what's played out, interestingly, is I think it's become a little bit of a world of haves and have-nots, right? I think there are certain sectors that have clearly benefited from COVID. And obviously the obvious ones are, you know, ed tech and gaming and, you know, media and content and SaaS and a bunch of other verticals. But, you know, surprisingly, even companies in the fintech space, a lot of people thought that, you know, lending companies will find it really, really hard. I mean, there have been some isolated cases, but, you know, broadly, it's not been as bad as people feared, right? You know, travel companies, Airbnb went IPO in the middle of all of this. We've seen, you know, companies in our portfolio who have actually, although the business in terms of actual travel bookings hasn't sort of, you know, still picked up. But surprisingly, some companies are actually signing more clients today than they were signing, you know, a year ago. And so clearly, I think the underlying theme is there is a move towards digital. Anyone who was not thinking about it late last year even or early last year was... now is actively, you know, thinking about, you know, multiple business continuity plans and digital as at the forefront all of that. And so I would say, I was talking to a CEO of a very large e-commerce company recently, and I was asking him, saying that, hey, listen, now that the dust has kind of settled, what did COVID really do to your business? And I think the answer to me was, depending on category, and this is a large horizontal, and he said, listen, depending on the category, we've seen acceleration of anywhere from, you know, 12 months to, you know, 24 months, maybe even 36 months in some cases, where, you know, people were just not willing to try because the earlier adopters had come in and then we were trying to, you know, penetrate this mass middle, but it was just going too slow. And I think what COVID did is just accelerate that first trial, you know, then second trial, and now it's kind of become a habit. And so I think there has been an acceleration. I think there are companies that in every sector that have tremendously gained from COVID. And then there are other companies that I think just need to hunker down, you know, stay lean, wait for the storm to pass, especially, you know, companies in travel and, you know, some companies in mobility and so on and so forth. And I think, you know, the reality is that, you know, this is a, you know, black swan event as far as, you know, they are concerned. And it's hard for anyone to plan for you know, multiple lockdowns, right? Because when you start pushing the pedal on growth again. But I think the what I've seen is the best companies have really hunkered down, really, really got a, you know, very sharp laser focus on cost structures. And I actually think they will all come out significantly stronger, because what's also happened in those sectors is the weaker companies have disappeared. And so once things kind of open up, I think the best one or two companies in each sector, I mean, it's clearly going to get separated, as you know, the best ones will emerge and will continue to grow even larger.
Got it. And so, I mean, it as an entrepreneur, right? Right now, a lot of our companies at AngelList India, and just generally personally, I interact with a lot of founders. It can be overwhelming, right? I mean, in the sense that at one end, you're trying to deal with personal loss, or you're trying to just, I mean, manage your teams during these tricky times. And then you read about these large rounds which are happening. And I mean, at crazy speed, right? The velocity and pace of deal making also is increasing at growth stages and stuff. So how do you, as an early stage founder who's still trying to figure out product market fit, what's your advice to them that they don't get bogged down by this excitement or euphoria that's going around in the ecosystem right now?
Yeah. You know, somebody had told me, this is an investor that I really, really respect. And I had asked him this question once, saying that, listen, you know, it all looks very easy from the outside, right? If I'm an early stage founder or an early stage VC, and I see somebody like you who's got like multiple unicorns and all of them sort of doing well and raising like large amounts of money at higher and higher valuations. And I asked him, hey, you know, how does one make sense of this? And I think this was around the 2015, 16, I think there was a slowdown, and after the 2014 kind of bubble. And I remember him telling me, it was a very simple statement, but it's always, you know, stuck with me. And he said, listen, Tarun, the best ones have tested my conviction more than once. And he said, even the companies that today people, you know, look on as the bellwether of Indian internet, those companies I've looked at days where they had like, you know, 30 days of cash, 60 days of cash. And so he said, listen, it's always, you know, it all looks very glamorous and, you know, nice from the outside. But inside, I mean, all these companies have, you know, their own sort of set of problems to deal with, right? And so I think I try to keep that perspective always. And I tell founders that as well, that, listen, you know, your scale of problems, the nature of problems will obviously change. But it's not that the problems just go away when you raise, you know, 10 million or 50 million or 100 million or 200 million, right? And so I think it's important for founders to keep that perspective, number one. Number two, I think they should also look at it to say, like, if you take, go back to the days of Naukri and, you know, MMT and, you know, the early IndiaMart kind of days, I mean, the amount of time, effort, energy it took them to raise, you know, the first 10 million, and I don't even know how many of them ended up raising more than 50 million cumulatively. But today, it almost seems like a joke, right? Like when somebody, every single day, there's an article in the paper saying so-and-so raised, you know, 50 million, 100 million. And so I would just say, listen, the depth of the market that all of us have been talking about is finally here. We finally have companies that are IPO scale. I know India has always been docked as a market that doesn't have enough exits. And I think the exits wasn't the problem, right? It was always a lack of depth of the market. And so finally, I think the market is here. We have, I think, you know, a dozen to maybe two dozen venture funded companies that, you know, technically could go IPO tomorrow if they wanted to. They all are doing triple digit $100 million plus of revenue. They all have, you know, decent, you know, margin profiles. They all are growing anywhere between 50 to 100% year on year, even at that scale. Have strong moat, strong defensibility, you know, stuff like that, right? Which is what is required to take a company IPO. And so I think if at all, what COVID, going back to your first question, that's further accelerated growth of companies, right? I know companies that were growing, you know, 30, 40% the year prior, and suddenly this year have grown 100%. And that's because of this whole sort of, you know, move towards digital. And so I think as an early stage founder, I would look at that and say, hey, the next 10 years are, if the last 10 years have been any indication, the next 10 years are going to be even better. And I actually see it as a, you know, massive positive and a massive motivator to say, hey, you know what, the story that all of us have been sort of, you know, looking forward to is that, you know, we'll see a full cycle, right? Early stage companies will go become large companies, will succeed, will go IPO eventually, you know, when and more money then keeps coming back into the ecosystem. I think that loop is finally closing. And I think when that loop closes, I think we will just see, I mean, I think we will see, I hate the China comparison, but I hate to make the China comparison, but the reality is some version of that is going to play out in India over the next 10 years, right? And so whether it's, you know, half a trillion or a trillion or whatever that number may be, the reality is finally now that that loop will close, I think we will just see massive amounts of innovation. Talent in the ecosystem is, you know, far better today than it was 5 years ago or 10 years ago. I remember there was a time one used to struggle to find a good product manager for the company, right? Today, we don't talk about it. There's enough talent available. I remember people used to say, hey, which, you know, head of sales or head of, you know, VP sales in a SaaS company has seen more than $10 million of revenue, right? Today, there's, you know, several of them. And so I think overall ecosystem has matured, founder, you know, quality has gone up, investor quality hopefully is going up, there's more money available, rounds are happening more, you know, quickly, there's less focus on terms and, you know, screwing, you know, founders over as far as terms are concerned. It's all standardized, just like it got in the valley. Talent pools are very, very deep. Repeat founders have a playbook that they're kind of, you know, showing, repeating over and over again, and other people are learning from that. And I think this is what eventually made Silicon Valley, or made, you know, Beijing, Beijing, right? And so I think we're starting to see early days of that in India. And, I, you know, honestly, I think it's the most exciting time for anyone to start up today in India.
No, I totally agree with many of those thoughts there. I think a word that's been thrown around recently, or that, I mean, it's been thrown around by New York Times for a while, actually. But over the last, I think, year or so, I think because of late stage activity and stuff, it's increasingly coming up. As a venture capitalist in India, or I mean, taking cues from the global market, do you think we're in a bubble? Cheap capital, public markets at a high, and economy is looking in an increasingly K-shaped recovery phase. Do you ever let that word cross your mind, bubble?
So I think, you know, this is a hard one to answer, right? Because as VCs, we all tend to sort of live several years in the future for good or bad. And so I think it's hard to separate the optimism from the, you know, what may seem like a bubble in the moment. See, I think the reality is, you know, we will always go through fear and greed cycles. I think at different points in time, things will reach a level where you will say, hey, is this just everyone being too optimistic? Right. And I know last year people thought, you know, stock markets, I mean, there was a time in March where the whole world was super negative when COVID first hit, and markets crashed like 40, 50, 60% even. And before you knew it, they were back to, you know, above pre-COVID levels. And today stocks are at all time high. Now, will someone say that these are, you know, markets are in a bubble? I guess that's one point of view. I think the way I look at it is, the markets have sort of factored in multiple things, right? And I'll start with the publics, and then I'll move towards what we're seeing in the private markets. So I think the public markets, one is, I think the first time in the world's history, there is a vaccine within a year of something this major happening, right, on the health front. And I think people have factored in the fact, you know, the fact that multiple geographies with large consumer spends have already been vaccinated or in the process of being vaccinated, or will get vaccinated in the next 3 to 6 months, right? Number one. Number two, companies have really, really cut flap. And so we are likely to see higher corporate profits than what we saw before. Third, to the point I was making earlier, in a lot of industries, the strong have become stronger and will continue to get stronger because the weaker companies have been wiped out. Right. And that's been the tragedy where, like, in a company, you know, in a sector, if there's like 5 different companies or 6 different companies, the reality is the 1 or 2 have survived, and the 3 or 4 which were less strong as far as their balance sheet was concerned, or as far as just their standing in the overall competitive landscape was concerned, those companies either have been wiped out, or, you know, there's been consolidation or whatever it is, right? And so again, markets are factoring that in and saying, hey, you know, if this company is now, like, you know, 3 of its competitors have gone away, what does this mean for their profits, right? And so eventually it's all a, you know, factor of discounted cash flows, right? And, you know, so I would say there is a rational way to explain, you know, why our markets are at the level at which they are there. And now, in isolated pockets, are some of these companies overvalued? Absolutely. So that's always been the case and will continue to be the case, right? But I don't think one can take a, you know, broad view and say, hey, everything's in a bubble. I don't think that's true. same thing will apply to a lot of what we're seeing in the private markets, right? The way I look at a bubble in private markets is the three V's, right? Which is value, velocity, and volume. Our volume of deals going up, I mean, just before we started the call, we were talking about, you know, certain angels who've done 45, 50 deals just this calendar year already, right? In under 6 months. I know, you know, some of our peer funds have done 20, 30 deals already this year. And so I think the reality is volumes are significantly higher. Seed deals that used to be 4, 5, 6 million pre are now standard has become 10, 12, 14 pre. If you have even some track record, either as a founder previously or as a, you know, exec at a, you know, well-known company with some, you know, good experience under your belt, I mean, it's not uncommon for those people to raise their first seed round at, you know, 20, 30, 40 million pre. And we're seeing some of that as well, right? And then obviously, if you look at, you know, velocity, I think there are companies that are closing, you know, three rounds of financing within 6 months, right? And so I think all of these are at play in some measure. But again, right, will some of these companies not work out? Absolutely. Will we see a few, you know, really, like if you look at the 2015-16 whatever bubble or whatever it was, right? You look back today, how many good companies came out from that bubble, right? Like just look back. I mean, there's you know, Swiggy, and there's, you know, Urban Company, and there's like so many. Again, I'm sure there's a dozen more names that I'm forgetting, but I remember this was at the time where everybody had said, oh my god, like this is the craziest bubble India has seen in the private sort of venture ecosystem. But even then, there were multiple strong companies that came out. And I think we will see the same thing this year as well. There will be companies that don't live up to the hype and don't execute and can't build a team. And, you know, their value prop sort of isn't as strong as, you know, the founders and the investors thought it is. Or it was limited to only a small segment of, you know, users, and they couldn't expand sort of that value prop to other users. But then there will always be companies that will just go on, and people will be surprised by the sheer pace at which these companies grow. And we're seeing that in our portfolio. Like some of the companies that, you know, 5 years ago when we founded a company and the amount of time it took to reach, you know, revenue milestone one. I mean, today it's happening in like a quarter of the time or a third of the time that used to take companies back in the day, like 5 years ago even. And so I think a lot of it is, I mean, we see by definition, we are future backwards, right? And so, and at some level, we're pricing companies. Yes, there is a bottoms-up pricing, and there is a, you know, some sense that it needs to make. But the reality is, you know, the power law dynamics are so skewed in favor of, you know, getting into the best companies. And so whether you get it in a 5 or 10 or 20, I mean, if it works, it doesn't matter, right? And if it doesn't work, it still doesn't matter, because you lose your capital and no more. And so I would say the fact that today VCs can see a clear path to large, and when I say unicorn, I'm not talking about $1-2 billion companies, right? There are companies that we know will be 5, 10, 15, 20 billion dollar companies. We already have some of them. I think the pace of creation of unicorns has gone up. The unicorns of today will be worth 5, 10, 15, 20 billion dollars in the next couple of years. And as exit sizes go up, it is bound to start changing dynamics at the early stage pricing. Because people who have made money by getting into some of those companies early will do whatever it takes to get into the best deals, even if it means paying up a high price, because they've done the math. And so I think, you know, one can use that logic to explain obviously paying any price. And there's always a balance between saying, hey, am I just going crazy and overpaying for this? Or, you know, am I just very clear? And there's always, you can't break the rule every time, but there's always the one deal or the two deals that you have very high conviction on, for which it makes sense to break that rule. And I think that's what we're seeing as a culmination, where people are just saying, hey, you know what, if I want to work with this founder, and if it means I need to, you know, pay up, you know, 20 pre to work with that founder, I'm going to do it. And so I think that's the thing. Now, does it look like a bubble from the outside? Yes, it does. But is there a, you know, is there a rational explanation to some of this behavior? I think that's true as well.
Wow, Tarun, I think that's the most sensible and the thoughtful answer to that question I've heard in the longest time. So coming, I mean, we've done the macro, coming to the micro, given sign of times, I mean, power-like dynamics at play and venture firms increasingly investing at a faster pace. And I mean, do you think the traditional portfolio construction theory for VCs is thrown out of the window, where you're not going by ownership targets anymore? You just want to get onto the best cap tables because the outcomes are so large? Or Is that something you think about actively when you evaluate a particular opportunity?
So we've actually actively done that, Utsav, and I think the jury's out on the results. We'll know in a few years. But I'll tell you, we took a strategic call at Matrix India like 2-3 years ago. And you know, when you look at again, and you know, going back to the power law sort of dynamic that exists in our world, the reality is every year there'll be, you know, let's assume the top five sort of tier one VCs invest in, you know, anywhere between say 50 to 100 startups a year, right? The reality is 5 out of those 50 to 100 will basically determine 90% of the returns, right? Now the question is, like, would you rather, you know, push for 20% ownership in every deal or 25% ownership in every deal, which used to be the case, and potentially miss out, right? Because today, I mean, all these competitors are outstanding, right? I mean, we're in competitive situations every single day with our peer funds, and you know, you win some and you lose some. But the question very often we've asked ourselves is, hey, you know what? What if we were to just collaborate, because we know what this other VC brings to the table, we know what we bring to the table. You know, could we potentially together actually deliver a better experience for the founders? I mean, essentially, we see ourselves as, you know, being the business of founder service, right? And so if we can help the founder build the company more, you know, effectively, and, you know, help increase the size of the eventual outcome, you know what, maybe we collaborate on this one together, get in early, potentially do the next round between us. And so maybe we don't get our 20%, but we start with 12, 13, 14, 15, and accrete to 17, 18 in whatever, if we can in future rounds. And that may still be good enough, because the you're not going to win 100% of the deals that you compete for, and the cost of missing out can be extremely high, right? Especially in ones where you have high conviction, right? And again, I'm not trying to generalize this, because again, you can't, you know, break every rule all the time. But I think applying judgment to say, hey, in which case which rule is meant to be broken, I think what we've seen is in some deals where we have very, very high conviction, we just say, hey, we're happy to collaborate with this other fund. We have high respect for them. We know how they work. We know what they can do to help you. And it actually complements very well with what we can do for you. And, you know, we're happy to split it, because there is a 50-50 chance that you're going to lose that deal. And picking between owning 0% of that company versus owning, you know, some double-digit percentage of that company, I mean, you'll always pick the latter any day of the week, right? And so I think this year, especially in our most recent fund, we've actually had probably the highest number of syndicated deals that we've ever had in the history of our fund. We've ended up doing this with a bunch of top tier funds, and I think it helps, because it's good for the founders, firstly, because they now have, you know, two VCs. If things are going well, both are hungry for ownership. If things are taking longer than they thought to sort of build, you have two VCs who can sort of give you a little bit more money to kind of, you know, help things, you know, going without, you know, depending solely on one VC, and it's higher pressure for everybody to put money when you know, things aren't working out as well as you thought they would. And I mean, you have, you know, network of two VCs and, you know, everything else, right? All that goes with it. And so I actually think, you know, ownership, we all, at some level it matters. Obviously, you're not going to do a deal for 2% ownership as an early stage VC, but as outcome sizes become larger and larger, I think sensitivity towards ownership will naturally come down. It's all a function of, you know, overall fund level maths that people will apply, and I think we'll reach the same answer. And I remember going to China 3 or 4 years ago, and we were very proudly telling our Chinese partners, I think in our fund too, our median entry ownership was like some ridiculous 27%. And we were boasting about that to our China partner, and he was like, hey, you know what, like, enjoy it while it lasts, because it's going to change very soon. And you know, it's happened. I mean, before we knew it happened, and we had to adapt very quickly to the changing environment.
Interesting. And Tarun, so you're a partner now at Matrix India. And what are the things that excite you currently? What are sectors or spaces that you're tracking more closely than others?
Yeah. So, you know, I think there's this one broad theme that I've been chasing that I really like, is this whole sort of deplatformization. I think Nawal had a tweet a few days ago, and he said the entire world is going to be one decentralized sort of economy, right? And something I'm paraphrasing, but basically he said the world, you know, future will belong to decentralized sort of, I think decentralized economy or something of that sort. But net of it is, if you see our bet on Dukan, right? Essentially what we're seeing is there is a feeling amongst several different, you know, suppliers across different verticals to say, hey, you know what, these platforms have become too powerful. They're squeezing us too much. We were too dependent on them to get business. Our existing customers have moved there. It's not just become a channel to get new customers. And now as they're turning their screws to move towards profitability, these people aren't left with a choice, right? And they're coughing up like crazy commissions. And, you know, there are articles that say commissions in some verticals in India are the highest in the world. And so I think there is a overall move by some of these suppliers to say, hey, you know what? Can I continue to have a hybrid strategy where I depend on sort of the platforms to get me some new business? But I can't, that can't be my only way to do business, right? I need to have some independent channel where I'm able to sell products, I'm able to engage my existing customer base, I'm able to run promotions. And can I all do that? Can I do all of that seamlessly using an app? And I think Dukaan plays really well to that theme. And we all have seen how Shopify did in the last, you know, 12 to 18 months. They're going, you know, faster and faster off a much larger base. And so I think some of that theme hopefully will play out in India as well. And as small businesses, you know, of every size adopt technology and, you know, start moving towards selling their products and services digitally. You know, we have the same kind of theme in the overall creator economy space, right? Where today a creator needs to go to a YouTube or a TikTok or an Instagram and, you know, finding ways to monetize is hard because there's just so much noise. There's no real tools that these people have to manage their own sort of, you know, following. And so I think that's the overall theme that I really like. And whether it's applied to products or services, I think it's going to play out. Now, there is a risk that it's still a bit too early in India. But, you know, if I look out 4 or 5 years, I think it's definitely going to play out. Right. And when you combine elements of community, when you combine elements of video, I think it starts looking like really, really exciting. And we've made a bunch of bets in that space. So that's one theme I like. I really, really like gaming. I think there is, and again, when I say gaming, it's just multiple different aspects of gaming. It's gaming tech. It's, you know, it's platforms. It's, you know, bunch of things, RMG. But, you know, if I do a 2x2 of TAM or market size versus profit pools, I think there are very few sectors in India that lie on the top right quadrant, which is large market size and large profit pools, right? EdTech is clearly one, and there's Byju's and Unacademy and, you know, White Hat and a bunch of others which have shown that one can blitz scale really fast because the market just allows for it. And at the same time, you can be, you know, have very strong and healthy unit economics and actually be profitable while you're doing it. I think the other such sector is gaming. And so I think we will see, I mean, Dream 11 has shown it. MPL is in early stages of doing it. We've got a company called Zupi, which is in some early stages of doing it. And we're just seeing these companies scale incredibly fast without burning much money. And it just, I mean, there's just such a strong PMF that some of these companies see. I mean, it's been, I've been amazed to see that, right? And there are others, obviously, where we see large TAM, but, you know, smaller profit pools. And those tend to be the red oceans where those companies just take infinite capital to get built. Eventually, they will create value, but it's just a stressful journey along the way because at every stage, you need to ensure that you're the company that's attracting the most amount of capital. And so I think these two, top of my head, obviously these will come in, but obviously across, I mean, if I take B2B, I think India has been a, you know, nation of, you know, small businesses. We've got like 50, 60 million of them. All of them, like I said, are looking to go digital. But, you know, we've made bets in B2B marketplaces, a company called Business we've invested in, which is doing really well. Captain Fresh, WeGrow, you know, a bunch of these companies and like just the tailwinds that some of them are seeing in terms of adoption. In terms of, you know, modernizing the entire supply chain, in terms of using technology to reduce like dump and wastage across the supply chain and, you know, fundamentally add value to the overall sort of economics of the industry. I mean, some of it has just been really, really promising to see. So I would say, you know, broadly, these two, three themes, there's several more I can talk about, but top of mind, I think these are the ones that I really like right now.
Amazing, Tarun. I think that's a good note for us to end the show on. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your valuable thoughts. I'll keep introducing you to founders who request for an introduction. So I'll take care of that for us. And thank you again for being a great supporter of Angelist India and enjoyed working with you and having you on the show as well.
Same here, Utsav. It's been a pleasure. And I know you're always very understated, but I think what you guys are doing for the ecosystem is outstanding. There are very few founders, who meet you or speak to you and aren't, you know, walking away just amazed by the energy that you bring to every conversation. And thank you for being a great partner to us along over these years.
Looking forward to doing more. Thanks, Tarun.
Great. Thank you so much, Utsav.